Welcome to Two Dope Boys and a Podcast. I'm Michael Brooks.
And I'm Phil McKenzie.
Two Dope Boys is a shout out from the margins. Each week we break down trends using the lens of culture to shed light on what's significant to your future and why. How you doing, man?
Doing good.
Always. Yeah, man.
It's summertime in the city.
I am one pretty much to never complain about the heat, but today, I don't know, I guess it's the humidity. I'm just like, whew. I just wish I was laying in a lake somewhere. This is where my country boy comes out. Yeah. I wish I was in Western Massachusetts.
Little Tom Sawyer.
Yeah. Oh, that was my shit. My favorite books ever.
Yeah, little straw hat.
Oh.
Corncob pipe.
Yes. You know this.
You know, feet crossed.
Dude.
Lying in the creek.
Dude. Yes. Yes.
As I a, you know all
as
that
a,
shit.
As basically a homeschooled kid in rural Massachusetts raised by hippie wolves, I had some experiences like that. Not a bad thing at all. All right. But speaking of, now we got to get two bad things, unfortunately. This is a pretty funny bad thing this week. What's the brand F up of the week? And just so we say up front, this did not involve super producer Matt.
It did not.
Yes.
Matt is innocent in this case. Totally and innocent. But it involves one of our favorite targets, which are airlines. Airlines are just the gift that keeps giving. And I know people are probably out there listening and saying, God damn it. Y'all motherfuckers talk about airlines a lot. But they make it so easy, we would be remiss if we didn't talk about this particular story. So American Airlines is the brand that has effed up in this case. And apparently, a woman by the name of Chloe King was on a transatlantic flight, American flight to Paris, and she falls asleep. And this is where all of Chloe's problems began, as she later finds out that there was another passenger, we're assuming male, that was jerking off in the seat next to her. And because poor Chloe was asleep,
Jesus Christ,
the flight attendant did not ask her to move or did not remove her. She only learned of this after she woke up and they told her that the passenger next to her had been jerking off. I would imagine that this is one of your biggest nightmares about flying is being next to someone jerking off.
I have to say, it wasn't even a nightmare because I actually, as cynical as I am, I just wasn't anticipating that. So, yeah, but I mean, so basically, no, but to be clear, what you're saying is that this guy was jerking off. She was sleeping. They moved another passenger, apparently, who was awake and being disturbed by this. None of this, of course, the guy wasn't like, they didn't stop the flight. He didn't get it. Like, everything was just built around like, oh, he's going to jerk off now, ma'am. Can I get you an extra pillow and move you to another seat? Oh, you're awake. Would you like a half off of a bottle of wine? We could give that to you for $4 instead of $8. The guy next to you is jerking off. See, what the fuck is the matter with the airline industry, man?
And the funny, well, not funny thing. The tragic thing is that they did this. Their reasoning is she was in the window seat. I'm assuming he was the center seat. And the other woman who was moved was an aisle. And she was awake during the jerking off. So she was noticed, obviously aware of it. Whereas poor Chloe's trapped in the corner, unknowing that this is happening. And this is why I pick aisle seats, man. You know,
I'm all aisle from now on.
Yeah, I'm team aisle all the way. I want full access to standing and being able to move around and people not jerking off around me when I'm on the flight.
So has there been any follow-up to this?
Just Jesus.
And they haven't even apologized. They haven't responded at all to this unbelievable F. Although, you know, maybe they should turn it to their advantage. Be like, hey, look, you want to jerk off on a plane? Fly with us.
Yeah, it's like, you have all the room you need.
Yeah, don't worry.
Extra leg room, yeah, extra jerk off room.
Sleeping, it's fine. We won't even inform them.
Tragedy ensues when you're on American Airlines. Be aware when you pick those window seats.
Indeed. That's the brand F up. We got to get to what's up. All right, so now we got to get to what's up. And for what's up, we have some interesting news, which Hypebeast is reporting. That comes courtesy of some research from Nielsen Music's annual mid-year report. And, you know, these numbers change, they shift. We're not quantitative obsessives. Maybe this isn't even the right way to look at it. But being that as it may, hip-hop slash R&B, which is still that's still such an interesting category to me, has pushed rock, I'm quoting now from Hypebeast, has pushed rock out of the top spot of the United States' most consumed musical genre for the first time ever. As of July, the music category has reeled 25.1% of the United States' music, while rock now falls in at second with 23%. Streaming services play a huge role in the shift, as rock is still dominant when it comes to selling albums, making up 40% of U.S. sales. Drake serves as the perfect example of the shift in genre popularity, as his recent More Life project reeled in more than a billion streams on Spotify. This doesn't surprise me. I mean, I think that, you know, obviously hip hop has sort of more than, and for a very long time now, really left behind any kind of notion of not being anything other than just pop culture, and, you know, dominant pop culture at that. I think any kind of other notions of hip hop sort of not being at the center are definitely people who are just sort of disconnected from current currents, or, you know, maybe have, you know, racial or social anxieties about it. I think more interesting, though, is definitely the notion, even with someone like Drake, who I have my criticisms of, but Drake, to me, what he's doing now, while clearly within the vehicle of hip hop, is very, you know, kind of synthesis driven. He's bringing in a lot of other influences, you know, soca, Afrobeat. And so I think the next play is more mashups and more hybrids, making these categories just as like in everything else we talk about and do, whether on the show or in our consulting or in your, you know, silo smashing work, how much, you know, are these categories even going to be durable in the long term? And ironically, hip hop as the sort of like dominant vehicle of original synthesis and mashup culture is kind of like emblematic of that. So it's fitting that as we kind of turn to this next trend, that hip hop, which is kind of the forerunner and the exemplifier of it, is kind of like taking the lead, even at the time when maybe taking that lead is less relevant now.
Yeah, I agree with that. I when I started seeing this posted, not only on Hypebeast, but, you know, several music blogs and news medium started to have this story. It's very important to define how they made this assumption, because it's like most consumed, and they're going largely on sales and now calculating streaming, and streaming is definitely dominated by hip hop and R&B. If you look at Spotify's largest and most popular group is Rap Caviar, you know, and they've noted the numbers of Drake and other streaming and other albums that come out as huge events. You know, if you think about even Jay-Z's latest release, the Drake release, Beyonce's release, like the creativity and the and these strategies are really being pushed in R&B and hip hop. And so for me, when I think about the music industry as a whole, this was something that to me has been kind of obvious. And rock music as a fan, I don't think is a type of music that is really culturally relevant in the way that it used to be. And so even when you think of the lexicon of language, something that we talk about a lot when, yeah, you know, being a rock star is a term that you would use for anybody doing something that's amazing. You know, if you want to pay a compliment to someone, you'd be like, oh, so-and-so's a rock star. So-and-so's this, so-and-so's that.
Appreciate
you know, and, you know, they should, if you're really being up to date, even though no one would ever say this because it's corny, you should be like, yo, that motherfucker's a rapper, you know, like that should really be the term for someone who's like knocking it out the box. Because even if you think about other musical forms, like how people talk about like EDM and, you know, tropical house and all that kind of stuff. Those DJs, even the art of DJing as a thing comes from hip hop. And so that as a cultural force is still homage to hip hop music.
Right.
All these people like Calvin Harris and Zedd and other DJs that are known for making, like, you know, DJ Khaled comes from hip hop, so he doesn't quite count, but they're all using rappers and R&B artists in their songs. So even if you don't say you come from that genre, you're still borrowed. You still want Migos on your song. Definitely. You still want Drake on your song. Like, you're still incorporating elements of hip hop and on R&B in your music. So I think from a cultural perspective, even if the numbers haven't borne out until this moment, hip hop has long surpassed rock music as being culturally relevant. And yeah. And the last thing I'll say, and then I'll give you more space, is, you know, they made a point to talk about consuming music. I would wonder, if you break those numbers down, if when they talk about rock consumption, how much of that is catalog versus how much of that is current? Right. You know, like, how many people are going out and buying, like, the latest Broken Social Scene record? And shout out to Broken Social Scene, I actually do like y'all. So it is not a diss. But how many people are going out and buying that record as compared to going out and getting, like, Sgt. Pepper because it's the 25th anniversary, right, and they might not own the remaster of Sgt. Pepper?
Look, when I'm looking for rock music, I'm looking for, you know, basically like Rolling Stones to The Clash. And I like new things that come out that are indie or rock, but I just don't track it in the same way. So I think that's, and maybe, you know, the other point, you know, is that I think you're right in terms of the kind of broader conversation. What I said before, that, you know, really it's just the center of pop culture. You kind of, you know, you added to that and expanded on that, and I agree with you. And I think that this is another example of the sort of, yeah, the kind of quantitative is the lagging indicator. If you were really tuned into how culture is moving, where the dialogue is happening, and what kind of is moving energy, you would have already known that this shift had taken place years ago. So this is just the numbers catching up.
Yeah. And the other point I'll make on this is sort of a genre point, is we talk all the time on the show about the lack of relevance of demographics. And I've always felt this as someone who's always liked all kinds of different music. And when you describe music to someone, one of the most limiting questions, unless it's like just blatantly obvious, is when people ask, like, oh, what type of music is that? And then you're struggling to fit it into a category. And I think, like, of course, when people read a story like this, because we have this racialized idea of music, and you know, we had Jack Hamilton on the show. I'm going to make sure I get the full title of his book. If you want to go into the archives, he wrote a book called Just Around Midnight, Rock and Roll in the Racial Imagination. And when I think about his work and many others who've talked about, you know, what does rock music mean when you think about that person making that music? What is hip hop and R&B when you think about that person making that music? I think this is an opportunity to sort of expand that conversation. Yes. You know, our crew, Rob Fields, you know, shout out to Rob Fields. He's someone who's been a heavy proponent for an event like Afropunk. And I think if you look at Afropunk as a festival that happens every year in Brooklyn, I think they're 7-8 years in. You know, the artists that they have on there are not traditional hip-hop R&B artists. You know, if I think about bands like The Internet or artists like SZA and, you know, all these artists that are out there that are making this sort of hybrid music, I think there's room to expand these definitions. And I think smart brands, smart marketers will figure out how to touch this untapped market and use this to understand it's about the culture, not about these labels.
Yeah, and that's what's up. We got to get to what's next.
Now we want to get to what's next. And this is a conversation that's going to talk about many of the things that we've discussed on the show before, particularly around the future of work, which is a topic that's come up on and off in different facets. And the source of this comes from the New York Times, dated July 12th. And the article is called "The Pop-Up Employer, Build a Team, Do the Job, Say Goodbye." And in the course of this article, basically what they describe is this idea of creating a team that's called a flash organization, basically assembling folks using automation, whether that's an app or a website, to basically find a team, dole out tasks, manage those in order to create something that is complex. This could be building a technology app. This could be doing a temporary project within a larger organization. But the key takeaways from this, from a technical aspect, is that most of this is done using algorithms to identify the correct staff, how they should be put together, what skills are needed, and then managing them primarily through online tools like Slack. And then when the team has accomplished their task, they pretty much disband, and then I guess as independent operators and contractors can go on to continue to do whatever else they normally do using their particular skill sets. The article uses a couple of good examples, one of which I thought was one that we wouldn't normally associate with this, is the idea of a Hollywood movie set where a team is put together to, you know, create, to film and produce this one particular movie. We tend to think of only the actors and the directors, but when you think about all the moving parts of food service and location scouting and building sets and all the technical tools, you know, when you stick around to them for a movie and see all those credits rolling, all of those people are designed to, you know, fulfill a task, which is, in this case, a huge Hollywood film. But when you take that and scale it down a bit, you can take that same idea and plug it into different organizations and different tasks. And we've often talked about the uncertainty of this so-called gig economy. Right. And that's what really jumped out to me as the most interesting thing. Not so much that this can be done. Clearly, all of these technical tools exist and the will exists to have highly skilled people come in and be able to accomplish something. But the part that sort of raised the eyebrow to me, not good or bad, but something I want to think about more, is this just more long-term uncertainty injected into an already unstable economy and kind of work relationships that we already have?
I mean, I think undoubtedly the answer is yes. And I think the answer is going to always, like, we almost have to start. We can't disaggregate them, but I just think that, like, these conversations are always basically coming down to me in two basic tracks, which is, okay, this is actually, to me, from a work perspective, very exciting, potentially very liberating, and could create some really interesting opportunities for Meshworks to not only build, you know, projects and work on businesses, but even potentially in very specific and targeted ways, like help with activism and social innovation. Like, there's a lot of different sort of uses for this. And we are completely, you know, I've used analogies before. Some of them are awkward, but of just essentially, like, we're in a triathlon economy with, you know, people who are really, really unhealthy, or, you know, what, like, you know, in the sense that, like, the foundations and the building blocks that we need behind these frameworks and these platforms, we don't have. And the most simple one, you know, and the least controversial from a kind of, you know, very basic reality point of view, would just be like, look, we can have a very creative driven, non-organization, you know, non-security dependent freelancer economy if we have universal housing, and by which I mean, you know, whether not necessarily government housing, but massive subsidies, streamlined efforts to get people, whether they be renters or homeowners, to be secured in housing and homes, universal healthcare, some form of universal basic income, you know, high quality education, plenty of other things, as a foundation upon which we exercise ourselves in this economy. And then once we have that kind of social investment and kind of basic investment in decency as a society, I think the platforms become even more interesting because they can be used, as I said, they can be used to build businesses, they can be used to make movies, they can also be used to, you know, address and solve social problems. You know, in the 90s, he might have gotten some specifics wrong, but I've referenced this book before. Jeremy Rifkin wrote The End of Work, and his focus specifically on that point, and might have been slightly overstated, although not as overstated as his critics at the time said at all, but he was focusing on automation and the sort of elimination of a lot of different jobs through robotics, which is happening and now has actually become a mainstream kind of trendy concern, even though he was dismissed at the time. And his point was, we can use that freed up human resource to solve a lot of problems. People can be, you know, rebuilding schools, people can be getting paid to be community leaders, people can be, you know, getting resources to be mentors, or we can, you know, have wasted human life and deeper inequality. And that's what we've chosen to do. So at a certain point, I almost feel like even though they're so deeply connected, it starts to become like deeply connected but two separate conversations, which is that we can keep innovating and keep changing these platforms and produce some very interesting tools, but the infrastructure and the social contracts around them are completely not caught up with them. And, you know, contrary to the kind of promises of technology in Silicon Valley, you're never going to supplant the need for universal government programs and other forms of intervention, no matter how fancy or fun the platform.
Yeah, I think this was like a perfect storm article for me. Yeah. Because obviously, you know, we have a consulting practice. Like, we... Right. Walk into organizations that are bigger than our two-person operation, and
right.
we help them navigate challenges that they have, you know, all the time.
Right.
You know, and they're bringing us in to supplement some of their efforts or to help them, you know, ideate efforts that might make more sense to make their businesses more culturally relevant. So there's
right.
there's that piece of it that I understand there's always going to be a freelance consulting type of relationship. And being that we do stand for this idea of de-siloing, you know, getting people out of their tracks in order to generate those good ideas and to find the things that are really going to work, because we are living in that more matrixed world. So right. I do appreciate the points that are made here. When I hear, you know, the bigger ideas that you're talking about, the need to incorporate the social catch-alls that are currently missing.
Right.
I think that all of these spaces need to get bigger.
Yeah.
In the sense that we're still tinkering around the margins with these separate spaces, you know, so, you know, you're talking about so much more bigger, holistic, and much needed innovations that are still held off separate from completing a task,
right.
you know, finishing a project, checking this box.
Right.
And one of the challenges, I think, for our work and others who are really concerned about these issues is to figure out a way to combine those two approaches and get out of the narrow confines of like task-based labor and solving these problems for a project and doing the bigger work of redesigning all of this. Like these companies should be building the stuff you talked about into their platform.
Yes, and I think that that's the way, you know, there might be the choices of, you know, I mean, not to idolize them, but those were old debates too. And, you know, there was the Ford model where, you know, Henry Ford was like, all right, I want people who work for me to be able to buy my cars, be able to afford to buy my cars. You know, there is that classic Keynesian model even in business. And so far, I think that, you know, in the beginning, these platforms, it's very weird the way the net economy has developed, because, you know, I think up until very recently, there was this there was this paradox of, on one hand, recognizing that this, that even going back to ancient fucking, you know, like pre whatever internet, you know, dial up internet was revolutionary and had major implications for commerce, communication, social life, and everything else. And people really hyped how revolutionary it was. But then on the other hand, it was like, oh, well, these are, this is just, you know, this is just fun computer stuff and apps and movies and, you know, fun things. And now we have to realize that it's like, it is actually quite literally revolutionary. It is fundamentally transformative. And, you know, when you look at businesses like this and the show and whatever, I mean, tons of incredibly positive and exciting opportunities. And now these companies need to decide, I think, like you're saying, I mean, do they want to get on board with, you know, our platform, our employees, every, you know, what the vision of society we have is free agents, freelancing, you know, open kind of, you know, creative and more kind of meshworks of people coming together. So we want to also support the social contract that goes along with that. Well, I think that that would be really far reaching and really intelligent. Unfortunately, there's a lot of, you know, still basic greed and libertarian bullshit in those worlds, which kind of holds that back. But ultimately, if this type of economy is going to be durable, it is going to be built on a foundation of, you know, massive interventions and massive public benefits. And we're going to need to stop even thinking in these ridiculous terms, like whether we have a capitalist economy or a socialist economy or anything else. Everything is a hybrid. Everything is always designed. And we need to think of whose behalf do we want to design it on behalf of, you know, the many or the few. It's pretty simple.
Yeah. And this does not even address issues of, these are still specialized gigs that we're talking about here. This is, has no impact on the price pressures towards zero, you know, another Rifkin reference, zero margin society, as we push, you know, lower income jobs, service jobs are increasingly heading towards zero, but even skilled labor is heading to zero slower, but it's still heading toward zero. So we have to dramatically reimagine and incorporate a social contract into any sort of conversation around ultimately what is the future of work, you know, whether we want to call it a gig economy, pop-up employment, flash type models, whatever branding terminology you want to use. Without that social contract built into it from the beginning, we're going to continue that race towards zero.
Absolutely. That's a, we got to get to the crates. All right, so now we got to get to the crates. This is where we give you a pick from culture. You know what it is. And I'm actually going to pick a profile, recent profile of somebody that I think Phil and I have both had dealings with in the past. I think Phil, I'm pretty sure, hosted him at Influencer Conference, and I hosted him on the Majority Report. Karn Ross, who runs a group called Independent Diplomat and used to be a UK diplomat before resigning, in fact, over the Blair government's push for the hyping intelligence for the invasion of Iraq. And he's created a group where he basically advises non-traditional actors in international diplomacy. So these are people that either represent states that have not been recognized, or NGOs, social activists, or also leaders of guerrilla movements. And there's an interesting new profile of him in The Guardian that came out on Sunday, July 9th, 2017, called The Case for Anarchism, How a High-Flying Diplomat and Middle East Advisor Lost His Faith in Western Democracy and Put His Trust in People Power. And it's a very interesting, essentially, case really for direct democracy, and also incorporating some of the ideas that have been practiced in Rojava, which is a Kurdish-run area of northern Syria. There's some, I want to say that that's a little bit more of a, that's a complicated picture. It's not something to romanticize, but there were some very interesting ideas being practiced there. And how he connects those two threads about anarchism and his new work in sort of non-traditional diplomacy is fascinating, and I think has a lot of implications for how we think about power in this new world. So that's my crate for this week.
Awesome pick. Karn is amazing.
Yeah, fascinating.
So he's a really, really cool guy. Awesome pick. Not surprised. My pick is really simple this week. It comes from the world of music, and WizKid dropped his latest record. He's for those who might not be familiar with him, even though he did gain some mainstream notoriety because he guested on a few Drake songs, so he's gotten more popularly known here in the United States. He is extremely popular in Africa, in Europe. He's a Nigerian singer, and he just dropped his latest album, Sounds from the Other Side. I just got it today. Been listening to it pretty much all day as I moved in and around the city. Dope, dope record. You know, it's not, you know, it ain't political, it ain't deep. It's just, if you just want joints, it's got joints.
I want this.
You know, so it's a dope, dope album. You know, I'm getting more and more into Afrobeat music. I'm playing a lot more of it when I DJ. So there's just a lot coming out of that world. You know, again, it's a theme we hit on all the time, that this, you know, this music is shifting and changing, and I love seeing that. And so highly recommend WizKid's record. Again, it's called Sounds from the Other Side.
Perfect. Another journey. Thank you, brother.
All right.
See you Thursday for On Point.